Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with us, Hans Hassel, Assistant Professor of Politics at Cornell College. He joins us by phone. Good to have you with us, Hans.
Oh, it's great to be here. It's great to be inside where it's not so cold.
Good. Dave Anderson is with us as well in our AIM studio, where we hope it's pleasantly warm there, Dave.
It is, thankfully.
Assistant Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Thankfully, Dennis just told us there's a slight warming trend here, so we have that to look forward to. And this entire hour of politics, plenty to cover. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Initially, we're going to be talking about what happened, the government shutdown impending at the end of this week, how that's tied up with debate over immigration, the way forward there, if you'd like to join our conversation. Also about, yes, that word. We know what that word is. I'll just be saying, I guess, S-hole this hour, even though Hans and Dave, I don't know if you've heard the debate about whether the actual word was S-hole or S-house.
I've heard that. I'm not sure what the distinction really is, but I've heard there is a debate.
But there is nearly a week-long debate we've had about this word. Listeners, does it matter to you what words the president used in that meeting last week? What are your thoughts on this nearly week-long debate about that word and the, of course, the meaning behind it? 1-866-780-9100. Well, this government shutdown impending at the end of the week, unless something is done. Republicans, I understand, preparing a stopgap measure, spending measure, funding for something there for the Democrats, funding there for children's health insurance program, the CHIP program. But this bill, as I understand it, and maybe, Hans, you have more insights here. It's moving very quickly in Washington. It would not address the future of the so-called Dreamers, DACA, would it?
That's what I understand. I mean, I think that this, like you said, this is constantly shifting, and because of the looming deadline on this, I think we can expect for things to evolve very quickly in terms of what's in there and what's not. But essentially, what it looks like is a short-term spending bill that is kind of what's been being pushed and it kind of to prevent the government from shutting down, but at the same time not appropriating for the entire rest of the fiscal year.
Mm-hmm. Dave, what is the narrative you understand from the last few days? I want to play a little Lindsey Graham here in just a moment, and I think you know what words I'm talking about. But give us as much of a narrative as you can see over the last few days, from the president being in favor of an agreement on DACA to where we got to that meeting with the profanity.
Okay.
To today,
it's bizarre. From all accounts, on Tuesday morning, the president called Senator Dick Durbin and said, hey, I think we have a bipartisan agreement. We're going to extend the budget. We're going to fund DACA. Well, let's get together. Let's get it done. Anything you guys want to put in there, I will sign it. And Durbin immediately called his friend, Senator Lindsey Graham, and said, hey, well, let's go over to the White House and let's work something out. And on Thursday morning at about 10 a.m., they spoke again with the president, and the president was still on board. So Lindsey Graham and Dick Durbin went over to the White House to just finalize the details. And they arrived inside the Oval Office to find that there were several immigration hawks joining them for this meeting, which they had not anticipated. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the president was not only not on board anymore with the agreement, but he was absolutely hostile to it.
Right. And let's hear from Lindsey Graham. This is part of he was taking part in this testimony before a congressional committee of the Homeland Security Secretary. But we'll take care of that in just a couple minutes. But while asking questions of the Homeland Security Secretary, Lindsey Graham wondered what had happened when President Trump seemed to change his mind about immigration. Listen.
Between 10 o'clock and 12 o'clock, we went from having conversations between Senator Durbin, which I believe every word, and the president that was very hopeful. And by the time we got there, something had happened. So Tuesday, we had a president that I was proud to golf with, call my friend, who understood immigration had to be bipartisan. You had to have border security. It's essential you have border security with a wall. But he also understood the idea that we had to do it with compassion. Now, I don't know where that guy went. I want him back.
Lindsey Graham, always the colorful language, good for radio especially. Hans, how do you see, is it clear to you what happened here?
To me, this seems very much in line with previous analysis of President Trump that basically indicates that he, you know, goes along with whoever he's talked to last. And I mean, there was some analysis, you know, late last year. Some other people had commented about that and in regards to, I don't remember what the policy was, but they were talking about how they had, you know, felt as though they had I think it was inside the White House, there were staffers deciding on, you know, what direction the White House would take on a certain issue, and someone, there was some comments that the president seems to go along with, you know, whoever he's talked to last, be that a staffer, be that a reporter, be that, you know, someone in his family, and I think that's essentially, it seems to me at least to be, you know, a kind of a continuation of that general trend that, right, whoever's got his ear has got to, you know, is going to be able to convince him pretty easily.
Mm-hmm. And I think there was speculation, perhaps more than speculation, that the person that got to the president's ear to make this change was one of his advisors, Stephen Miller. Dave, perhaps you know about this. I mean, he's an immigration hawk, right?
Yes. Stephen Miller absolutely wants to completely reinvent our immigration system. And he's a very close advisor to the president. The president often listens to what Stephen Miller says, and he is likely to be the person who could have really riled the president up like this. It wasn't just that he changed his mind. He suddenly became absolutely opposed and was outraged by the idea of a bipartisan deal.
Dave Anderson, Hans Hassel with us. What are your thoughts, listeners, on this latest chapter in the immigration debate? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Of course, I'm sure with the number of listeners that we have families of Dreamers, and certainly Dreamers themselves listening. So please join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to the debate about the word. This was, bizarre, has already been used. I'll use it again. It seems to be the word that we use very often in politics these days. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen testified at a congressional committee hearing yesterday that she did not hear the particular word that has gotten so much attention, supposedly said by President Trump. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, at that testimony, asked about the meeting that both he and Nielsen attended. Listen.
You said on Fox News that the president used strong language. What was that strong language?
Let's see. Strong language, there was apologies. I don't remember specific word. What I was struck with, frankly, as I'm sure you were as well, was just the general profanity that was used in the room by almost everyone.
Did you hear me use profanity?
No, sir. Neither did I.
Did you hear Senator Graham use profanity?
I did hear tough language from Senator Graham. Yes, sir.
What did he say?
He used tough language. He was impassioned. I think he was feeling very strongly about the issue, as was everyone in the room. And to underscore a point, I think he was using some strong language.
Do you recall that the strong language he used repeated exactly what the president had said prior to that?
I remember specific cuss words being used by a variety of members.
I'm not going to ask you to say those words here.
Okay. Senator Dick Durbin with the Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen. Durbin said on CNN that he has not changed his account of what was said at the meeting with the president.
I stand by every word I said. And Senator Cotton and Senator Perdue should remember a word as gross as that in the course of a conversation with the president of the United States.
Okay, Cotton and Perdue, two senators who, changed their story from I can't remember what was said to, I know definitely the president did not say that.
Yeah, it's not always clear. I mean, you look at Nielsen's testimony, right? She says, I did not hear that word used. But right, what is that word? And maybe right, they're not necessarily denying the use of profanity, but they're using, you know, the specific word. And so part of that could be, you know, mishearing a word or, you know, the kind of minor semantics to try to downplay the situation in some way.
Right, right. And let's be clear, it's not about profanity, is it? I mean, in an earlier report, I said that word here. Everybody knows what the word is, so I don't need to repeat it. It's not about the profanity. It's about the implications of the president saying that about people from Haiti, about African countries. Right, Dave Anderson?
Yeah, it's... Again, I have to say it's just bizarre that we are caught up in the semantics of, well, did he say S-hole? Was it S-house? I mean, he's just saying these countries are S-y. And that's really the point, is that in a discussion over immigration, two bipartisan senators walk into a room to sign a deal to move forward on this issue, and instead they were confronted with some opposing viewpoints that said, hey, you know what, these people are from some pretty SE countries.
And we don't want people from SE countries.
Right, we don't want them here. So
I would disagree. I mean, I think that this gets the press coverage because of the profanity. I mean, I think that Democrats and others would say that this is, you know, emblematic of, you know, perhaps a certain worldview that is incompatible with the way that we see things. But I don't think that this gets press coverage unless there's profanity involved. And that's what I think what has really attracted attention. And then it becomes a larger, you know, discussion about, right, what is this, how does this reflect on, you know, the president's worldview and how he views, you know, certain countries and certain people. Mm-hmm. But I don't think this gets press coverage without the profanity. And so I'm not sure that you can say that this is not just about the profanity.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder, though, if he had said these people are from hellhole countries, which is, I think, a little bit more acceptable. I hope so, now that I said it on the radio. If he says that, does the story go away? I think it still persists.
Mm-hmm. Join our conversation with Dave Anderson, Hans Hassel, Politics Wednesday, discussing that word, whatever it was. There's been so much reporting on it. Does it matter to you, the words that the president did or didn't use in that meeting last week? What do you think of the debate we're having about this word and its implications? 1-866-780-9100. Of course, the wider, broader topic of immigration, the long sought after comprehensive immigration solution for our country. Kirk is joining us from Muscatine. Hi, Kirk. Welcome to the program. Kirk, are you there? Kirk doesn't seem to be there. Okay, let's go to Chris, see if Chris is in Des Moines. Hi, Chris.
Morning. Afternoon.
Good afternoon. We're hearing you loud and clear, you. Chris. Go ahead.
Yes, I was calling to, you know, it's with the how he described the African nation, I think that also shows how he feels about people of color, and I think that is totally being missed and totally being ignored as far as his racism and his discrimination. Mm-hmm. And especially when you have people on your administration that are very racist, and that's the thing with Stephen Miller. He's no different than the Breitbart guy. They're two birds of a feather.
Okay. Chris in Des Moines, thanks very much for your call. So this coupled with, again, and this has come up before, Hans, that the president, the question surrounding the president, is he a racist? Of course, the president's people, supporters maintaining he is not. But this raises that question once again.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is something that's very difficult to navigate. You go back to the Republican Party for a long time has appealed to certain types of voters on the basis of not on racism, but on ideological grounds. Right. So you go all the way back to Barry Goldwater and his Southern strategy. The Southern strategy for him was to recognize that his ideological views aligned with a certain subset of Southern conservatives that had certain racial views. And so it's often, I think, very difficult for us to identify, you know, what's motivating these particular statements. I think you can be motivated to make these statements not on the basis of race, but on the basis of economics or skills or a variety of other things, and maybe those are based off of misperceptions, but they're not explicitly kind of racial views. But at the same time, they happen to be highly correlated with a racial kind of worldview.
Mm-hmm. Also related to the DACA question, the Justice Department appealing a court ruling from earlier this month that blocked the Trump administration from ending DACA. This is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. They're called Dreamers. It's a program that provides work permits to undocumented immigrants raised here in the U.S. Some have been here for decades, as I said, since they were children, since they were brought here. No decision of their own. The Trump administration said it has appealed the judge's injunction. So the program must continue for now. The administration has appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. But then the Justice Department says it's going to take a rare step later this week, filing a petition asking the Supreme Court to intervene here. Yesterday, Attorney General Jeff Sessions saying it defies both law and common sense for the DACA program to be mandated nationwide by a single judge in San Francisco. So, Dave Anderson, unravel this a little bit. The president wanted to end DACA or set a deadline for ending DACA so that there would be a fire lit under Congress. That's one interpretation, right? And now the courts are there.
Yes. To reuse a word I'm just stuck on today, again, this feels bizarre because President Trump said he was going to get rid of the DACA program, which was created through Obama's executive action, but at the same time indicated that he really wanted the program to stay. He just wanted Congress to enact it into law so no future president could get rid of it. Congress then indicated that there was bipartisan support for enacting some kind of legislation with DACA, but they haven't done it in 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wound up in the courts. Several states sued to say, well, hey, this is going to create an undue burden on us, and the program should be forced to stay. And, you know, I would turn Attorney General Sessions to an Introductory to American Government course to explain why one judge in California can do this.
Why is that? Explain it.
This is the first step for all challenges to government inaction. You go to a federal district court, you hear the case, and that justice has a broad authority to make very wide-ranging decisions. And if the losing side of that case doesn't like it, they can always appeal it to the appellate court. And if they don't like a loss there, they can then appeal it to the Supreme Court. This is standard judicial practice. Mm-hmm. The Trump administration has twice now expressed shock that this is the way that government works. And that in itself is unusual and bizarre.
Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Zachary in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Zach. If you go by Zach, I hope you do. Welcome to the program. Zach, are you there? Shoot, more technical problems with our phones. Let's talk a little bit about this. Ideally, Hans and Dave, when the president said this, that he was ending DACA in March, it could have gone another way and still can go another way. If Congress would act, a legislative solution, and we can go to such heights as perhaps dreaming of a comprehensive immigration deal, would have been much better than any executive order. So it could have been lauded had Congress stepped up to the plate, Hans?
Yeah, so I think this is actually a very good example of kind of the lack of presidential power here in this administration. There's a wonderful book written by former presidential advisor Richard Neustadt, where he talks about the power of the president is the power to persuade, which is essentially this ability to convince other people that their vision for the country is the vision that other people should follow along with. And this is essentially what President Trump is trying to do, I think, with DACA, is stating right here's my view is that this should be enacted, and it should be enacted through congressional legislation. But then he's unable to pull that through. And I think that all of these sorts of things that we've been talking about today are examples why President Trump lacks that presidential power, that power to persuade. He has no credibility on Capitol Hill. His public opinion polls are very, very low. And so all of these, both of those components, I think, make it very difficult for him to pull out legislation or push legislation that he views as important. And so, right, the statement about DACA, right, it has no presidential leadership behind it. It has no presidential oomph to force Congress or encourage Congress to actually take it up. And so, what you're seeing essentially is Congress doing the things that they're interested in doing, and what Republican leadership is interested in doing, which doesn't necessarily always align with what President Trump wants to do.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes before we have to go to break. So each of you look forward to the end of the week. Dave, will we have a shutdown? Will there be agreement that what could make the few Democrats? Now we need more than just Republicans in this particular instance, right? We need a few Democrats on board to make this happen for the Republicans. Is there a deal that can be put together, you think, before the end of the week?
I think there is. I really don't think anybody in Washington has a real stomach for shutting down government. It's a big political move that has no benefits for anybody. It damages the country. It damages government. It damages both political parties. Nobody wants to shut down. And I feel reasonably confident that a deal will be brokered.
Mm. Hans, I guess the idea here, too, would be how long, if we're going to fund the government, how long will it be funded for? I understand sort of Democrats look to a shorter time period than Republicans. They'd love to have it funded for a year and not have this on the table, right?
Yeah, I think the Republicans view this as, right, can we get this off the table and not have this additional kind of political game that we might have to play that might further damage electoral opportunities this coming fall. Mm-hmm. But I think this really, going back to the original question though, I think it really depends on how much Democrats view that they might be able to be blamed for this. Right, if they can point very clearly and put the blame on Republicans who control all three branches of government for a shutdown, right? Then that becomes, I think, it becomes more likely. However, I'm not sure that that's necessarily what's going to be seen. I think that people will recognize the role that Democrats have to play in order to get the budget funded. At least for a short term.
Mm-hmm. We'd have to imagine Democrats voting against a short-term funding bill that includes funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, right?
Yeah.
Which is, I don't know, is that hard to imagine, yeah?
I think that's exactly, I think that's hard to imagine. They may not get everything that they want in that short-term funding, but they will get something, and I think it will make it very difficult for them to vote against it. It could be, very poor political optics in a number of ways.
Okay. Hans Hassel, stay with us, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. Dave Anderson, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University. Dave and Hans will be with us in the second half hour. We'll talk a little bit. What do we want to talk about? Steve Bannon called before a grand jury. We'll ask our analysts what that might mean. What are the possibilities there? Also, we'll ask them for reflections on 1 year of office for President Trump. And also, today was the day, if you remember, that the president said days ago would be the fake news awards. What happened to that? Evidently no planning. Will that happen? I guess no one knows. Maybe the president knows. We'll be back in just a moment with more of River to River Politics Day. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a few minutes.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The World Health Organization and the American Psychiatric Association recently classified video game addiction as a mental disorder. That's the focus of our show tomorrow. Iowa State University psychologist Doug Gentile will be with us. He'll explain why he thinks the decision to classify video game addiction as a mental disorder is similar to the decision in the late 1950s recognizing alcoholism as a medical condition, not simply a personal failing. We'll also hear tomorrow from a former video game addict, a doctor of medicine whose life was destroyed by his addiction to a video games. That's tomorrow on this program. It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. We have Dave Anderson with us of Iowa State University, Hans Hassel of Cornell College. I'd like to have you join our conversation as we move from immigration, DACA, and the attempted a version of a government shutdown at the end of the week to what we've learned about the Russia investigation. Donald Trump's former chief strategist, Steve Bannon, subpoenas last week. We learned about it this week by the special counsel to testify before a grand jury as part of that investigation into possible links between the Trump campaign and Russia. This marks the first time the special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, is known to have used a grand jury subpoena to seek information from a member of the president's inner circle. Dave Anderson, what do you make of this latest revelation?
Well, it looks like the investigation is kind of turning towards a new direction. Steve Bannon is not implicated in the other things that we know Mueller has looked at so far, like the meeting with the Russian lawyer. He wasn't there. The firing of James Comey. He wasn't central to that decision. So he's clearly looking at something that we haven't talked about yet. And the move to invite Mr. Bannon into a grand jury subpoena is a little different. It means that he's probably not the subject of the investigation himself, which with other people we've talked about so far, it seems like they themselves may be under investigation. But it looks like Bannon himself may not be. Mueller doesn't necessarily think he's done anything wrong. He just may know something.
Mm-hmm. Hans, do you think it's a coincidence? It would be a strange coincidence that this subpoena announced last week comes during the, let's just call it the fire and fury breakup between Bannon and the president. Is there a connection in that perhaps Robert Mueller saw a window of opportunity here with that breakup?
But I don't think I have any evidence one way or the other. I'm not privy to those discussions. But I mean, I think that's a logical conclusion. Right, the causality there may not necessarily be the case. It could be the timing here. I mean, it's hard to tell, right? We don't have any information about what's actually going on inside the investigation. Right? We don't know. It's been a fairly tight ship. There hasn't been a whole lot of leaks in terms of what they're investigating or what they're considering, which I think is a good sign that everybody's on board. I think to say that this is definitely because of fire and fury, I think it's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. White House physician Dr. Ronnie Jackson says that the president's overall health is, quote, excellent, and that the president had received a perfect score on a test to screen for neurological impairment. Now, President Trump is 71. And also in this briefing yesterday, it was made clear that the president asked for the cognitive test to try to quell questions. I guess the idea to quell questions about his mental abilities. Dave Anderson, does this put to rest all that speculation that's been building about the president's mental fitness for office?
I'd say not even remotely. The cognitive test looks for some kind of cognitive impairment, as in like neurological problems. And I don't think that a lot of the people who are claiming the president has cognitive problems are really saying that he necessarily has brain damage. I think they're asserting that he is not competent and fit for office.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that, Hans?
I think one thing to remember here about this is, I mean, some people have questioned the doctor's partiality. Whether he's part of a, in some ways, is it fake news what he said? And I think it's important to remember this is not a partisan doctor. This is the same person who checked up on President Obama as well. And so I think that's important. That's one aspect to remember. Some people have been pointing to the President Trump's height and weight, which happened to perfectly align with him just being under obese and as a sign that this is kind of rigged in some way. But I think it's important to remember that this is not a political appointment.
We have all kinds of measures for, if you or I were to be interviewed for a job in a lot of places, in corporate America for sure, we would be tested in many ways. But yet the highest office in the land, Dave Anderson, does not require any, and I'm not speaking just of this president, but wouldn't that make sense?
I would say no, because if you start creating kind of evaluative measures of who is allowed to be president, whoever gets to make that test has a lot of strength in determining who can be president. Mm. In our Constitution, we specifically say things like, well, you can't have a religious test. A lot of people would like to say, well, the only way to know if you're moral is if you can prove that you're religious. And are we say flat out in our country, no, you can't test people for stuff like this because whoever's running the test gets to rig the result.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about 1 year on the Trump presidency. Donald Trump inaugurated 1 year ago this week in late January. Specifically, there's so many facets we can talk about here, but his attacks on the press. Speaking on the Senate floor this morning, the Republican Senator Jeff Flake, who importantly here has announced that he's not running for re-election, called out President's harsh words about the American press. Last year, Trump called the press the enemy of the people.
It is a testament to the condition of our democracy that our own president uses words infamously spoken by Joseph Stalin to describe his enemies. It bears noting that so fraught with malice was the phrase enemy of the people that even Nikita Khrushchev forbade its use, telling the Soviet Communist Party that the phrase had been introduced by Stalin for the purpose of, quote, annihilating such individuals, unquote, who disagreed with the supreme leader. This alone should be the source of great shame for us in this body, especially for those of us in the president's party, for they are shameful, repulsive statements. And of course, the president has it precisely backward. Despotism is the enemy of the people.
Okay, Jeff Flake, speaking just a little while ago on the Senate floor. Dave Anderson, your thoughts on as we mark this 1 year in office and how this president has treated the press. Sure, no president, the president gets a lot of flack from the press, a lot of tough questions, hopefully. But this president has treated the press much differently than even someone like Nixon.
Yes, this president has reinvented how the executive deals with the press. And he's done it in ways that anybody who studies democracy gets very worried about, because the press is our conduit to understand what our government is doing. And when a president starts arguing that the press cannot be trusted, we cannot trust the press, it means that the American people have no way of learning what's going on in government unless the president tells them.
Right. But this coincides, and Dave, I think you're aware, if you brought it to my attention, a new study that shows that people do not trust the news media.
Yeah, there's a new study out about what people believe about the term fake news. And it says that it splits on partisanship. Democrats believe that fake news is anything that is written that's false and is trying to deceive the audience. But 88% of Republicans believe that accurate news stories that portray a politician in a negative light can be called fake news. And that boggles the mind in some ways, because they're saying that real events, reporting the truth, can be called fake news and dismissed. And if you believe that, I don't know how you're supposed to operate in a democracy. How are you supposed to learn what's happening in Washington or Des Moines in any true sense?
Hans, your thoughts?
I think this is a constant struggle between media and politicians. Theoretically, both of them need each other. Right? The media needs politicians because they need to sell news to consumers. Politicians need the media because they need to get their message out to voters to win re-election and to push and promote their policies. I think what President Trump is doing is essentially trying to embrace an end around the media in some ways to be able to promote the policies that he's interested in, while also being able to dismiss and kind of put aside the media coverage that may not necessarily be helpful to him. And I think that I'm not sure that I agree with Dave in that this is as disturbing. I think I view this as the next step in a relationship between politicians and press that has happened forever. And this may change as you get different politicians who use different media strategies. But Trump has embraced social media as a way to get his message out. And I think that he's embraced ways that try to move to appeal directly to the people, to try to convey what a politician is most interested in conveying to voters. And essentially, what you've got here is this evolution of, right, how can a politician get their message out without having to pay the negative consequences to be accountable to the media or to have things that they don't want get out. And I think yes, it is troubling in some ways, but at the same time, it's also a natural evolution. I think I suspect you're going to get other politicians embracing this sort of way of dealing with the media, but also at the same time sharing information that will hopefully get out to the people as well.
So what I hear you saying, Hans, is that this is not a blip. A momentary blip. This is the way things will be, that we will not return to most people believing incredible news by credible news sources.
I mean, I think that if you look back at the original partisan media that we had at the turn of the century, right, the penny press and previous to that, right, where you had explicitly partisan newspapers, people were still able to get information. They just learn to adjust that information based on the source, and I think that people are good at using heuristics and recognizing when perhaps a paper's kind of views may not necessarily be accurate because of the biases and the incentives that they have. Mm-hmm. I think the same sort of thing is going to happen here. We may all read President Trump's tweets. But we're gonna understand what that perspective is that he's coming from, and understand when to trust those tweets and when not to.
Mm. Dave Anderson, do you think we'll become in that way more sophisticated in our news consumption or fake news consumption?
No, I really don't think we're going to become sophisticated and able to kind of counteract it. At some point, you have to accept that there is a reality out there. And if you want to create policy or have a government that deals with reality, you have to accept the truth at some point. And if we continue this downward spiral and just argue that we don't need facts, you can create your own reality and it can be whatever you want, we kind of give up the whole premise of democracy and government. And then we lapse into some kind of authoritarianism where whoever's the leader gets to tell us what reality is and we have to just obey.
Dave Anderson of Iowa State University, Hans Hassel of Cornell College, our political scientists, wrapping up this Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. Let's talk about what I'll call the curious case of the fake news awards that never happened. Let's just go through the plot of this story, and then I'll have you, perhaps, Hans, I hear you coming in there, to unravel the mystery, and like Columbo, tell us what's going on here. According to a January 7th tweet, today, Donald Trump will name the most corrupt and biased of the mainstream media. But it appears, the press secretary has, for instance, been questioned repeatedly about this, that there may be no event, at least no news media that outlets that know of any preparations. Yesterday, for instance, White House press secretary Sarah Sanders told reporters when asked about the awards, quote, "We'll keep you posted on any details around the potential event and what it would look like." Now, going back 10 days, Donald Trump said that he had pushed the date back for these fake news awards. The original date was January 8th. And one reason he gave was, quote, "The interest in and the importance of these awards is far greater than anyone could have anticipated. Subjects will cover dishonesty and bad reporting in various categories from the fake news media," he tweeted earlier this month and signed off, "Stay tuned." Now, this story goes... His initial idea goes way back to November 27th. Thoughts, Hans, you jump in here, on this mysterious event or non-event that is happening today?
I think it's just incredible that the fake news awards are fake news, right? That's very meta. That's what's astounding to me is that they have this announcement and then it turns out to be fake news. I just don't know. I mean, what I've read about it is that they, just like you said, they haven't put together the planning for it. It's not clear that it will actually happen, or whether it was an attempt to generate some buzz at some point, but then never actually rolled out or anything like that. So it's very hard to tell what's going to happen.
When it was initially announced via Twitter, some said, "Oh, that's obviously a joke, Dave." But we are left not knowing, right?
As with much from this administration, we're not ever sure whether it's a joke or not. It seems like President Trump wanted to do something and then maybe got distracted and nobody took it seriously, but then it apparently is treated as if it may be serious, which just seems to be very indicative of how this administration runs. Nobody's really sure of what's going on at any given moment.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the Democrats quickly. Play some stark comments made this week by the chair of the Democratic National Committee, Tom Perez, to Politico magazine. He says Democrats can't go into the midterm campaign just as anti-Donald Trump. Let's listen to a little bit what he had to say to Politico magazine to see where the Democrats are in this midterm election year. Tom Perez saying that the Republican Party is complicit in bad ideas, especially when they don't speak out after Trump's supposed harsh words about certain countries.
What to me is striking is the appalling silence of Republicans. It is clear to me that the party of Lincoln is officially dead. It has become the party of Trump, Moore, Arpaio, Ryan, McConnell. Paul Ryan said in response to his comment on Haiti, that was unfortunate. You know, it's unfortunate when it rains before a Nats game. It's unconscionable when somebody does something like that.
Okay. So Perez, Dave Anderson, insists the Republicans are in worse shape in this interview that he gave. Even though the GOP controls every branch of government in Washington, it also controls the governor's mansions in most states and the state houses. So what kind of shape are the Democrats in, and what kind of shape do they need to get into? What do they need to challenges they need to meet in order to meet what is traditionally a win for the minority, the party in the minority in a midterm election?
Yeah, the Democrats need to find out what they stand for. And I think at this point, we still have no idea. We know the Democrats don't support Trump or anything he stands for, but that's just not enough. We learned that in 2016 with the Trump victory, is that you have to, as a party, actually believe in something and stand for something. The Democratic Party for a long time has said that, yes, government can be used to successfully solve problems and improve people's lives. But we're still waiting for the answer of, well, what do you want to do with government right now? Opposing the Republican Party simply is not enough.
Hans, and there are internal problems in the Democrats' party. Competing factions?
Not to the same extent there are in the Republican Party. I mean, I think that the biggest thing that Democrats really need to do is to recruit good candidates. And so far, it suggests that they're going to be able to do that. Most congressional elections, right? Most elections of the congressional midterm elections are, in some ways, a referendum on the president. But it also helps a lot when you have a candidate who has the experience and the qualifications to and is a good campaigner. And I think that's really right. If Democrats are going to pick up a bunch of seats, that's going to be crucial to their ability to take back the House.
Last couple minutes, let's reflect on Donald Trump 1 year in office. Here's a Politico Morning Consult poll taken earlier this month. Interesting comment on this. About the same percentage of voters give Trump a failing grade for his first year as president as think he deserves an A or a B. 35% of 34% there. And of course, we still have the gender gap remaining. With men more likely to be positive towards Trump's performance in this first year than women, of course, highly partisan. Trump's best marks come on the economy, jobs, fighting terrorism, his poorest marks, handling of health care, the national debt, and foreign relations. Comments on this poll to wind up our show, Dave, or your reflection that you want to leave us with about Donald Trump 1 year in office?
Well, I think what we've really learned about Donald Trump 1 year in office is that his supporters who were excited about him when they voted for him in November of 2016 are still with him. They have not been shaken. It is an open question about if they can be shaken from him. But it seems like as long as the economy is doing well and we don't suffer a major terrorist attack, his supporters are with him probably to the end.
How do you see it, Hans?
Well, I think that these numbers are very reflective of the kind of the lack of persuasive ability of President Trump in Washington right now. This goes back to what I was saying earlier. Right? The power of the president is the power to persuade, and part of that ability to persuade is the standing that the president has among the American people, and those numbers very clearly indicate that the people don't think very highly of him, right? More, like you said, a higher percentage give a failing grade, and yes, like Dave said, that there are, you know, a subset of voters that are still supportive, But right, the vast majority or the plurality think that he's doing a very poor job. And I think that that then affects his ability to take any legislative leadership or any leadership in D.C.
Okay, quickly, in the next few days, next couple of weeks, what will you be keeping your eyes on? Very quickly, Dave Anderson.
DACA. I'm really interested to see what happens with DACA. I'm pretty sure we're going to have another short-term funding bill that kicks the can farther down the road. We'll see what happens to the Dreamers.
Indeed, we will. Hans, your words looking forward?
The fake news awards. Let's hear them.
I hope we make it.
Hans Hassel, assistant professor of politics at Cornell College. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Dave Anderson, assistant professor of political science at Iowa State University.
Whoa.
Okay. That didn't happen.
Thanks for having me.
Dave Anderson, thanks for stepping into the studio. River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.